From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Guerlot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. Joshua Landis and I talk about riots in Egypt after a court in Cairo dropped its case against deposed dictator Hosni Mubarak, and how counterterrorism has overtaken all hopes for democracy in the region.
Clearly, the president has decided that we're going to protect American citizens, and that means that the Middle East comes second. And for many people, that's hard to take.
And then I'll talk with literary critic Warren Mahdi about his work collecting tens of thousands of moments where characters gaze into mirrors.
Mickey Spillane rubs elbows with Marcel Proust, and I think there are probably very few places where that happens, but I can testify that they have very interesting things to say to each other.
Scenes of reflection in international literature. Right after this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Guerlot. Joshua Landis, big news this week coming out of Egypt. Former President Hosni Mubarak was released from jail this week. He was undergoing trial because of all of the violence that was used in killing protesters in Tahrir Square. And so he's been released. He's been acquitted. He's not going to be found guilty. But yet you have 200 or so people that participated in that violence who've been sentenced to death. So this seems like a bit of a contradiction in what's going on in Egypt. And people are protesting once again. Decision. And so what does this mean? What are the implications here for Egypt?
Well, it's a symbolism. I mean, obviously, this is a man who ruled Egypt for many decades with an iron fist. Certainly, the Islamists saw it as an iron fist because he arrested many of them. And the revolution was to get rid of military rule. And here we are back again with Sisi, military rule once again in Egypt. And it looks like we've come full circle. And so this was very symbolic for everybody because in many ways it says, you know, the Arab Spring, all the hopes that were attendant on it of democracy, constitutionalism, rule of law, dignity for the citizens of the Middle East are once again stalled. And here we have military dictatorship. So it was coming around full circle.
Well, as far as hopes being dashed, perhaps we can extend that also to other parts of the Middle East. Let's talk about ISIS, for example, and terrorism in the Middle East, or what now the United States and European leaders are suggesting is the number one goal in the region is to counter terrorist activity from, you know, hurting people outside the region, to contain the violence and to prevent terrorist attacks. So there was a meeting this week of foreign ministers. Secretary Kerry was there in Brussels to discuss these things and advance the policy of counterterrorism and not democracy and democratization and human rights and dignity.
You're absolutely right, Suzette, because we're not talking about democracy promotion anymore. It's all about stability, how to preserve the states, and counterterrorism. And for many Middle Easterners, and particularly the activists who put their shoulder to the wheel trying to get democracy, this is a dark moment for them. But for the United States, we've come full circle. We are frightened of destroying more states. We destroyed Iraqi state, throwing Saddam Hussein, Libya turned into chaos, and now Syria, Assad. The U.S. faced against very hard choice. Turkey, Saudi Arabia, others pushing us to bomb Assad, and we're bombing ISIS. And that has really brought our priorities to the fore, which is counterterrorism.
So this is a contradiction, you think, in what we were promoting in the region before and what we're now saying is the number one threat or concern is not political development, economic crisis, but countering terrorist activity going on in the
region. Well, many people are saying it's a contradiction because we should be destroying the old order and helping a new order through and not, in a sense, trying to patch up the old order. On the other hand, from an purely American point of view, clearly the president has decided that counterterrorism was what it's all about and we're going to protect American citizens. And that means that the Middle East comes second. And for many people, that's hard to take. And we just saw most recently both Iran and Assad sending their warplanes to bomb sites where we had just bombed, like in Raqqa, Syria. Assad came within minutes, within an hour of our bombing this capital of the ISIS. Assad bombed it too. Iran did the same thing in Iraq. And many people said, how can you be allowing these people to be bombed? Aren't they your strategic partners? And we are denying that they're our strategic partners, but they're in a sense being very coy and driving this policy forward to show that, in fact, they are our strategic partners in the war against ISIS.
So, but we're not obviously not we're not stating that publicly. But if you look at what we're doing in Syria and what Iran is doing, right, in Syria and Iraq, we basically have the same policy. We are strategic partners in that sense.
We
right?
are. I mean, we are strategic partners,
even if it's not out in the open and we're not being upfront about it.
Yes, we're not. We're not communicating with Syria and coordinating any attacks, but we will not go to war against Damascus. And this is why Turkey and others want a no-fly zone. They want us to go to war against Assad, even if it's in a small part of Syria, to be taking that territory away from Assad, which would put us into war. And we're saying no-fly zone. We're not going to do it. And that's caused us a lot of grief with our allies, Sunni allies in the Middle East.
So on the surface then, it appears that we are strategic partners with an enemy, Iran, and Syria, at least the government of Syria. And yet we're not doing what our allies, Turkey, wants us to do, what Saudi Arabia wants us to do. So how are we going to make sense of
that? We've changed our policy. You know, it's 3 years ago, President Obama said Assad must step aside. Today, he's protecting Assad by destroying his enemies in Syria and not going to war against him. In many ways, the U.S. sees Assad as a bulwark against the spread of ISIS and al-Qaeda in Syria. And that's why they won't destroy him, because who will take Damascus if it falls? So we have, in a sense, come full circle, just like the Mubarak incident in Cairo. The ironies are plenty.
But it's because of the threat or our perceived threat about terrorism.
Revolution brings insecurity and turmoil.
All right. Well, Joshua Landis, thank you so much, as always, for your insight.
Pleasure. Great to be with you.
If you have any questions or comments for me or Joshua, leave them in the Worldview section of our website, kgou.org. We're also on Twitter, at WorldviewsKGOU, at Suzette Grelot, and at Joshua_Landis. Next, I'm joined by longtime literary critic and University of Colorado professor Warren Motti. I'm Suzette Grelot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot. My guest, Warren Motti, has spent the past 4 decades studying English, French, and Anglo-American literature. He's a professor at the University of Colorado in Boulder, where he specializes in contemporary writing, especially experimentalist works that question accepted notions of literary form. His latest book, Mirror Gazing, collects tens of thousands of moments across a variety of genres where characters focus on reflective surfaces. Warren Motti, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, Warren, you've written a very interesting book about this concept of mirror gazing. It's a book really about reading. It's like reading a book about reading. Can you kind of just tell us, first of all, what that means, mirror gazing, and how that relates to reading?
I can tell you that, yeah, it about 35 years ago, when I was a graduate student, so a very, very long time ago, I started becoming interested in scenes in literary works where characters look into the mirror. And I started collecting these scenes kind of as an antidote to the dissertation that I was writing at the time, just to have something of my own to do and so forth. And as I started collecting them, I got more and more fascinated in them. And I saw that in certain of these scenes, you know, the person would gaze into the mirror and recognize herself or himself. In other scenes, that recognition would come with more difficulty. And in other scenes still, the person wouldn't recognize herself or himself at all. So I collected these, you know, in my readings over the years, and finally I ended up with somewhere between 12,000 and 15,000 of them. So in each of these scenes, there's someone looking into the mirror. And I slowly realized that part of what I was interested in was the gaze itself, the way that people look at themselves or gaze at themselves in the mirror. And I realized a little later still that I was actually looking at these people while they were looking at themselves, and that a lot of what interests me was the gaze itself in the representation of the gaze itself in a literary text and the representation of the gaze in reading, that is, reading is looking.
So let me pick up on that, what they're looking for when they're reading. So what it sounds to me is that you've found some consistency among multiple literary works in terms of people. There's some scenes where people look at themselves in the mirror. But you've taken that actual kind of physical doing, right, of gazing at oneself in the mirror to extending that somehow to what you expect to see, what you and how does that translate into then kind of like what you expect to read in the book?
Well, I think there's a broad spectrum of possibility. People can sort of gaze at themselves or look at themselves in the mirror for very pragmatic reasons, in order to shave, for instance, or in order to brush their hair. People can look into the mirror in an effort to figure out who they are and how they want to try to be in the world. You know, so it can range from something very, very practical to something far more sort of personal, even metaphysical. And I'm interested in that variety of gaze, you know, the way that it can shift so dramatically. I think that in terms of my own approach to these scenes, I'm a formalist. So what I'm interested in is kind of the shape that these scenes take, rather than how they play out in every single instance, and the kind of message that they convey or might convey about how the human subject represents himself or herself to himself or herself, and how that kind of representation can be played out in literature, in other forms of art as well. I mean, there are lots of mirror scenes in other forms of art, but what I'm interested in is literature. So how that kind of representation of the self is played out in literature.
That's Warren Motti, a literary critic and University of Colorado professor. We'll talk more about his 2014 book, Mirror Gazing, right after this short break. I'm Suzette Gorlott, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlott, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. This half hour, I'm talking with University of Colorado professor and literary critic Warren Motti. We're discussing his book Mirror Gazing, that collects scenes of reflection in literature and explores what they suggest about a person or a character's self-regard. So why do you think it is that so many of these kinds of scenes are present? And you just mentioned you have tens of, you know, more than 10,000 that you've collected. Yeah. Why are they so often used, and are they some sort of, you know, literary form that you actually use, some sort of mirror scene to represent something, to reflect, if you will, a certain perspective?
You know, there are mirror scenes in ancient literature. In fact, there are mirror scenes well before there are mirrors, as we know the mirror, the object. You know, I mean, think of the Greek myth of Narcissus, where Narcissus gazes at himself in the pond. There have always been mirror scenes, I think, in culture. But mirror scenes become more and more frequent as we approach the present. And our time is a very, very specular time. It's a very it's a time that's dominated by the mirror. Think of all the other sort of analogous phenomena that attend our culture. Now, think about the selfie, for instance. That's a very recent phenomenon indeed, but it's basically a mirror scene, right? People taking pictures of themselves. So I don't feel authorized to speculate about culture in a very, very broad sense, but I do know that in literary culture, the topos of the mirror scene becomes more and more frequent as we approach the present.
I think that's an extremely interesting analogy, and the fact that you're connecting it to something else in our daily life today, like the selfie. I mean, a selfie can be used in many, many different ways, not only to reflect yourself, but also to communicate something, yes, right? I mean, this is like there are certain applications, for example, like I'm just going to use one, Snapchat, that where you snap a picture of yourself and send it to somebody, and it you're communicating with a facial expression, yes, or you're communicating something with your mirror, as opposed to just typing in something with your thumbs, right? So is that the kind of similar thing that you're seeing in a literary form, is that the mirror scene, the mirror gazing, those are communicating something kind of purposefully and not just a description of what somebody's doing?
They are absolutely purposeful. Yes, absolutely they are. Often the mirror scene testifies to the way that the human subject sees herself or himself in the world. So a mirror scene wherein the subject recognized herself or himself with difficulty might testify to that person's alienation. A mirror scene where this where the subject failed to recognize himself or herself at all would testify to a to an alienation that was more catastrophic still, right? I mean, I guess in the literature of the 20th century, we expect somehow the human subject, the individual, to be sort of alienated from the world. What we expect less, I think, is for the subject to be alienated from himself or herself, and that's a prospect I think that for most of us is very terrifying indeed. The notion that you might go to the mirror and look at yourself and not recognize yourself. And those moments in literature are consequently very, very harrowing ones indeed, but they all do communicate, certainly.
I think it's also interesting that sometimes you pick up a book and you read it, and no matter what the scene may be, you get something out of it that's unexpected. And what I'm hearing from you is that using this actual tool within the within the book itself, but that the book itself is actually providing you something that you didn't expect to get.
Yes, and books always do that. That's one of the great, you know, values of books. They're just infinitely surprising, to me at least. And I've spent my life reading them. I mean, I read bulimically. It's terrible. But yeah, I've collected so many of these scenes, and they never fail to surprise me. They still surprise me on a daily basis. And one of the most interesting things for me was going back over all these scenes that I'd collected over the years, because I went back through them at one point in order to write my book one by one, and consequently I revisited a lot of books that I had read in the past 35 years. So it allowed me to revisit those moments of astonishment and pleasure in another way, in a different way, and to put those moments to use in a way that I hadn't anticipated. It was a very, very enriching experience for me.
Well, I want to shift a little bit to kind of the area of the world that you've specialized in terms of literature that's written in the French language. So is this concept of mirror gazing, this reflecting that we're talking about, is this something that you see across cultures? I mean, we're talking kind of about very human activities here, right? Reflecting on oneself and perhaps seeing something you recognize or not. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this seems like something you would see very broadly. Is that the case? I mean, even beyond French literature?
It is. I can confirm that. Yeah. You know, and I started out in English literature. I did a BA and an MA in English literature before I went to French literature. I teach comparative literature as well. So I read a lot of different kinds of literature. I read a lot of European literature other than French. I read North American literature, English literature. I read a lot of Latin American literature for fun, just for fun. I read a ton of popular literature as well, detective novels, spy novels, things like that. So I mix it up quite a bit. And indeed, in my book, Mickey Spillane rubs elbows with Marcel Proust, and I think there are probably very few places where that happens. So they're in conversation there. It's probably the only place they're in conversation. But I can testify that they have very interesting things to say to each other. Yeah, I do read a lot of different kinds of literature. And my own sense is that the incidence of these mirror scenes is neither greater nor less in French literature than in any other national literature with which I'm familiar. The difference comes in time period. As we just talked about that, as we come toward the present, as literature becomes, like the rest of culture, more and more specular, then mirror scenes tend to multiply.
So the mirroring going on within the literary work is very much a reflection of one's culture in terms of timing, but yet it's not something that varies from culture to culture in terms of how it's used or, you know, I guess all humans, regardless of where they're from, you know, use reflection in some way, shape, or form to communicate things or to find meaning in something, whether it's themselves, their own lives, what society, whatever it may be. But perhaps do it in at a different time, in a different way, but that it's – we all do it.
You know, my sense is that there are a great many things in literature that are culturally coded, far more so than these mirror scenes. But to my way of thinking, these mirror scenes are pretty international in character, for the reasons that you just, you know, adumbrated. So, you know, whereas other features might vary, you know, the relationship of characters in a novel to food, or family structures in the novel, or social structures in the novel, and so forth and so on, those would vary from culture to culture undoubtedly. But these scenes are so fundamental, it seems to me, that they don't vary that much from culture to culture, although they do from period to period.
Well, Warren Motti, thank you so much for being here today and helping us reflect on this topic. I appreciate it. It was very interesting.
It's a very great pleasure. Thank you very much indeed.
You've been listening to my conversation with Warren Motti, a literary critic and professor at the University of Colorado in Boulder. We've been talking about his latest book, Mirror Gazing, and there's more information online at kgou.org. Worldviews is a collaborative partnership between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Brian Hardzinski produces the show. Our interns, Sarah Hurd and Hallie Arias, prepare our content for the web. And Symphony Swift serves as our research fellow. For Joshua Landis, I'm Suzette Berlott.